from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Palestinians will continue their struggle to end the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. That's what the representative of Palestine told reporters following the rejection by the Security Council of a resolution that set the deadline of 2017 for ending the occupation. Late Tuesday, the 15-member Security Council voted on the resolution submitted by Jordan. Derek Mbata reports.
Jordan, which represents the group of Arab countries in the Security Council, submitted a draft resolution calling for a peaceful resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict within 12 months. The resolution also advocated for the creation of two independent and democratic states, one for Israelis and the other for Palestinians. 8 members of the Security Council voted in favor of the resolution. The United States and Australia voted against it, and 5 members abstained. The Council is charged with maintaining international peace and security, and its resolutions are binding. The Jordanian ambassador, Dina Kawa, said her country and the Arab group regretted that the resolution did not pass.
We in Jordan will continue to support the Palestinians in all their efforts. The fact that this resolution did not pass does not mean that we will be stopping. There will be other efforts and we will continue to support them. This time, for us, the importance of this resolution has been to put some momentum and dynamics in the Security Council, and we feel that this momentum is very successful, so we will continue.
Ambassador Samantha Power of the United States, which has a veto power, said her country did not support the resolution as it was not balanced.
We voted against this resolution not because we are indifferent to the daily hardships or the security threats endured by Palestinians and Israelis, but because we know that those hardships will not cease and those threats will not subside until the parties reach a comprehensive settlement achieved through negotiations. This resolution sets the stage for more division, not for compromise. It could well serve to provoke the very confrontation it purports to address.
Ambassador Riyad Mansour of Palestine saw the situation differently, as he explained to reporters after the vote.
It is very unfortunate that there is one country, regardless of whether you have 8 votes or 14 votes, that has the veto power that is capable of not allowing a resolution to be adopted. Our effort was a serious effort, genuine effort to open door for peace. Unfortunately, the Security Council is not ready to listen to that message. That is very unfortunate. However, our people will continue their struggle. They will continue their efforts.
Israel's representative said the Palestinians have had every chance to negotiate. Having refused to engage, he added, they tabled what he called their preposterous unilateral proposal and warned his Palestinian counterpart that he could not agitate and provoke his way to creating a Palestinian state. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
The Palestinians lost no time in their follow-up. On Friday, the permanent observer of the state of Palestine to the UN, Ambassador Riyad Mansour, spoke with the press following his meeting with Stephen Mathias, the UN Secretary General's assistant for legal affairs, after Palestine had filed copies of documents relating to its accession to 16 international conventions and treaties, including the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. Palestine could be admitted to the court by March 1st. Daniel Dickinson has more.
The Palestinian government has confirmed that it will launch court action against Israel at the UN-backed International Criminal Court, or ICC. Speaking at United Nations headquarters on Friday, the ambassador of Palestine said retroactive action had been requested for alleged crimes committed by Israel in Gaza from June to August last year. The 50-day conflict between Israel and the Palestinian faction Hamas led to the deaths of 2,000 Palestinians and 70 Israelis, as well as the widespread destruction of property. Riyad Mansour, permanent observer of Palestine to the United Nations, said the request was made to the ICC in The Hague on Thursday.
We delivered last night a letter to the Office of the Registrar in The Hague requesting retroactivity with regard to the crimes committed during the last war in Gaza and reserving our right for other retroactive crimes committed by Israel.
The Palestinians formally submitted an application to join the International Criminal Court to the UN Secretary General on Friday. It will take 60 days to complete the accession process to the court. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Oren Rosenblatt is a deputy consul general at the Israeli consulate in Shanghai. He told RT Thursday that Palestinians have more than Israel to worry about if the conflict is brought before the war crimes court.
I think that the authority that should be concerned about joining the ICC and to be prosecuted is the Palestinian Authority themselves. Right now, the Palestinian Authority, part of the Palestinian Authority, is the Hamas. The Hamas is a well-known terrorist organization, just like ISIS. And when the Palestinians are joining the ICC and the Palestinian Authority, part of it is the Hamas, they should be threatened by joining the ICC. We don't feel threatened. We know our Israeli defense forces. We know the way they act. We know the way we investigate ourselves. So this is not our concern. This is their concern.
Sir, a lot of people officially don't accept that Hamas is actually a terrorist organization anymore. You've compared it to ISIS. But the international community would quite disagree, Europe specifically.
No, Europe is agreeing. The fact that there was some kind of low problem with declaring Hamas as a terror organization, that is going to be solved. But I don't think there is any dispute about it at all. The Hamas, they are saying themselves that they are a terrorist organization. They are saying we are firing rockets on civilians. So what is the meaning of a terrorist organization? Organization that is saying our aim is to hurt and to kill Israeli civilians. They aim to kill my kids. So they are specifically say about themselves that they are a terrorist organization.
But they say they do so to protect themselves. But I want to ask you, Israel's threatened retaliatory measures over the application to The Hague. What does that mean? What kind of retaliation?
The Israeli government hasn't decided yet what kind of diplomatic acts we should do. But as I said before, what we think is that this is not the way. Unilateral act is not the way for peace. The way to peace is very simple. Join us at the negotiation table. This is the way to peace.
The Koreas could be sitting at the negotiating table this year if Pyongyang has its way. Premier Kim Jong-un called for a summit with Seoul in this year's annual New Year's message. China's news agency CCTV had this report.
The DPRK's top leader Kim Jong-un has proposed talks of the highest level with South Korea, opening the way to a historic summit. Kim made a sudden move during his traditional New Year message. It would clear the path for the first top-level inter-Korea meeting since a 2007 summit in Pyongyang. Kim also urged Washington to make a bold shift in its policies towards Pyongyang. It denounced the U.S. for leading an international campaign over and North human rights record. The South Unification Ministry, in charge of inter-Korean affairs, welcomed Kim's overture, and the ministry urged the North to quickly accept its proposal for high-level talks this month.
Our government is looking forward to holding talks between authorities from the South and the North in the near future, what format they may have. The government of the Republic of Korea feels there's a need for practical and open-minded discussion on mutual concern between the South and the North, including the issue of the separated families, which is the biggest tragedy of the 70-year-long division, and the issue of the highest-level talks, which the North mentioned today.
Meanwhile, Washington has chimed in with what seems lately to be almost a diplomatic verbal tick. More sanctions on Pyongyang. The Obama administration doubled down Friday on its allegations that the country's leadership was behind the hacking of Sony Pictures, announcing new sanctions on 10 senior North Korean officials and several organizations. Obama administration officials said the action was part of what the president promised would be a, quote, proportional response, closed quote, against the country. Although White House officials admitted that there was no evidence that the newly sanctioned officials took part in ordering or planning the Sony attack, according to the New York Times Friday, one unnamed U.S. official said, quote, "The administration felt that it had to do something to stay on point," closed quote. The U.S. actions may well turn out to be more symbolic than substantive. North Korea already faces some of the heaviest U.S. sanctions of any country in the world. As a new year dawns, we take a look around the Western Hemisphere with Tony Solo, our reporter from south of the border, at what some of the news and events we've covered in the region over the past year might mean for the countries of Central and South America and the Caribbean in 2015.
There have been several elections this year in Latin America. Here in Central America, there were important elections in Costa Rica and also in Panama, which were won by relatively progressive political movements that are something of a setback for U.S. policy in terms of building up their Pacific alliance. People listening have an idea of what that means. And the Pacific Alliance is a group of countries more or less closely allied with the United States, Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile, who are committed to a free trade slanted economic integration in Latin America, oriented in particular towards Pacific partners across the Pacific Ocean, in particular the ASEAN countries and China.
Right.
And of course, Japan. And so when Costa Rica and Panama had their elections, and they were won by relatively progressive organizations, and that was a mild setback for the United States in terms of its drive towards building up a Latin American coalition to support what many people in the States are against in terms of the international trade relations, what's it called, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a major corporate welfare boondoggle global kind of agreement.
The neoliberal model.
Yeah, and very much and you can see the way that U.S. policy desperately seeking to maintain United States, the control of the United States corporate elites at a global level, are trying to push forward that Trans-Pacific Partnership and also push forward the transatlantic investment partnership.
Yeah, you know, let's try to help people visualize this. If you put in your mind a map of Mexico, Central America, Caribbean, and South America, the countries that the United States has been able to work with, including Panama, where they took a setback, and including Colombia, where they took another kind of setback. You have Mexico, Panama, Colombia, and Chile. Now, if you imagine those...
And Peru.
And the bulk of the remainder of that entire region is working towards an entirely different economic model in one to one degree or another.
They're more focused on doing it from a solidarity and cooperation-based point of view and not from a cutthroat free trade point of view.
Right.
An enormous setback for the United States was the victory of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, and
oh,
she
yeah.
took office again for her second presidential term, I think it was yesterday.
Right, that's right.
And made it very clear that her commitment is to developing the so-called BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa global framework, which is trying to develop an alternative economic system free of dollar dominance, not dependent on the dollar, using all kinds of different financial and economic arrangements to create a system that is a truly multipolar system,
right.
That is one not dominated by a single superpower, which was basically the situation from 1990 until just a few years ago, really. But that's all changed dramatically. And I think one of the things that Yeah, I think you and I agreed on that one of the things that is a characteristic of the current international situation is that change is happening much quicker than people thought it would. And for example, if you read the economic relatively liberal economists and economic bloggers in the United States, they've all said, "Oh well, there may be moves against the dollar, but the dollar is secure and it's going to remain the important reserve currency for the foreseeable future," and so on. Well, they may be right, but events are moving so fast that they're likely to turn out to be wrong.
Right. Yeah, there are certainly indications. Look, another map. You have Brazil staying in the same direction, the same orientation that it's followed under Rousseff and Lula before that. And the advancements, for example, with the BRICS and also with the regional integration. And if you look at a map of the world, the BRICS, you have Brazil, the largest country outside of Canada, United States, in the region and, in the hemisphere. And the second largest economy, I believe, right, to the United States. And yeah, you have Russia with its both its economy and also gold reserves and, by the way, strategic nuclear capacity. You have China, the largest market in the world and the largest economy, or closing in on that. And then India, the second largest market, and South Africa, one of the largest economies in Africa. And all of the regional integration, rainbows that flow from that. That's a big prospective global challenge to the United States.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that people have underestimated, and the global analysts that you read, insofar as it's possible to take them seriously at all, I tend to overlook the key role of Latin America in the developing global situation. Another key thing that most of the global analysts miss is that, and they talk, but they still talk in terms of, will the dollar remain the reserve currency, or will the yuan of the Chinese, or what will happen to the ruble, and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And it's true that all that financial aspect of things has its importance, but if you look at what China's doing, China's just saying, well, nuts to all that. We've got all these trillions of dollars, and we're going to invest them in infrastructure that's going to help us develop our economy.
Right.
And we're not going to put 1,000 military bases around the world to recycle our dollars for, which is what the United States does.
Right.
And one of the little understood facets of the U.S. network of military bases is it serves a financial function of recycling U.S. dollars. But that's another story.
Right.
What China's doing is, it's saying, right, we've got all these dollars, let's invest it in international global infrastructure that's going to enable our economy to grow and meet the basic fundamental needs of our people, because our philosophy is not based on profit. Whatever people say about Chinese communism, and its relationship to capitalism, and the fundamental reality, especially under this new president, President Xi Jinping, is that they are focused on the needs of the human person in terms of their population. They're not focused on corporate profit.
That's right.
And so that's why they're investing huge and unbelievable amounts of money in infrastructure projects around the world, like the Trans-Latin American Railway that they're currently negotiating with Peru and Brazil, and which Bolivia has just sent a delegation to Beijing to talk about. That, that's a massive transcontinental rail project. They're talking about the Nicaraguan Canal. They may well be involved in the construction of the new Suez Canal. They're talking about all kinds of... Pepe Escobar of the Asia Times has written a lot, very cogently, about this, that what they call the new Silk Road infrastructure between China, crossing Central Asia and into Europe. And so when you look at events in the Ukraine and Syria, and why is all that happening? That's happening in part for kind of very short-term reasons to do with the existence of Israel, but in the longer term, the events in Ukraine that have been provoked by, and Syria that have been provoked by NATO, the United States and its NATO allies, are designed to banjax or stop or halt or slow down the development of China's incredible vast infrastructure investment across Central Asia into Europe.
Right.
And so all that stuff's tied up. And when you look at it from a Latin American point of view, and particularly from here in Nicaragua, and the canal is a key part of that global strategic move by China, and it makes China a very natural ally for the progressive countries in the Bolivarian alliance of countries, Ecuador, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, the Caribbean island nations, two new Caribbean island nations, Grenada and what's still in St. Kitts and Nevis, joined Elba this year. And what is it that they ideologically have in common? Because their focus is on the development of their populations, with the focus on the needs of the human person and not on corporate greed. And it's so fundamental, and it makes so much of the Western economic analysis completely irrelevant, because they just don't understand it. They don't get it.
Even from their perspective, using one of what they would call a real politic view of things, even now, but particularly, especially after the canal is built, the United States is not in a position any longer to isolate Cuba, for example. If Cuba and China can trade cheaply using the canal, what does Cuba need from the United States? And if China can invest in Cuba, which it has plenty of money to do, why would they need to worry about investment from the United States? It's an alternative.
Yeah, talking about the canal, and you get so much foolish comment from people who should know better. You know, and for example, recently there was an article, a really stupid article by the very, very eminent analyst, Brazilian analyst Emir Sade. And he wrote about the strategic importance of the canal and how it was going to be important for the development of the Cuban port of Mariel as a superport, perhaps somewhat similar to Rotterdam. Mm. But he spoke about the internal situation in Nicaragua out of total ignorance. And his comments were so stupid. It was an embarrassment. It brought to mind to me, Don, the ridiculous, the complete abject moral failure of all the kind of sacred monsters of progressive international analysis like Noam Chomsky and Ignacio Romanet and Gilbert Achcar and all those people over Libya.
Right.
And they were just hopelessly, pathetically, stupidly wrong about Libya. Mm-hmm. Although they'll never admit it now.
You know, Libya was pretty easy to call because they used the same playbook they used in Iraq. And now it looks like Iraq.
Yeah, so what you're getting here in Nicaragua is you're getting something, a very, very, very minor version of what's going on in Venezuela. You've got a ridiculously in Venezuela, the opposition enjoys something around 30% support, something like that, maybe a little bit more. But in Nicaragua, then the political opposition can't even muster 10% national support. And it's these people who are crying out in opposition to the canal. And so they hold occasional demonstrations. Recently, they shot a police officer and stuck another 5 or 6 police officers in hospital during a demonstration purportedly against the canal. And all that is completely artificial.
This is the only issue they got. This is the only issue that they have right now that they can bite on. And if this goes through as planned, they will be in the opposition forever, because the government responsible for making these major changes, improvements to the country, will get credit for it at the ballot box over and over again.
And here in Nicaragua, what's likely to happen is that progress will happen on the canal The environmental feasibility studies will be presented sometime end of March, early April. The heavy machinery that will actually start work excavating the canal is likely to arrive at the end of the year. But it's going to take a while to get the infrastructure in place for that heavy machinery to be able to operate. But I mean, and the process here in Nicaragua is so positive and so very much in favor of the government. I think they had another record year of exports this year, despite the severe drought in the first half of the year. And so here in Nicaragua, people are very, very positive about the future. And as you say, the opposition are just getting more and more desperate because they're on the road to nowhere. If you look at the rest of the region, and Honduras is likely to have another very difficult year because the problems in that country of the increasing hold that organized crime and drugs crime is getting on Honduran society is not going to stop. It's going to be a very difficult time for people in Honduras. In El Salvador, and this year we saw the election of the FMLN, and in Salvador people are very optimistic because the government is promoting redistributive policies very much in line with what Mauricio Funes set in train during his previous administration. In Guatemala, again, things are likely to be quite dire for people because there's almost constant political crisis of one kind or another in Guatemala. In Costa Rica, things are likely to improve because the new government is taking much more sensitive measures in terms of response to popular needs, to the people's needs. And of course, in 2014 saw this dreadful, horrific event in Mexico, which is completely symbolic of the breakdown of Mexico's political and administrative institutions, the massacre of the 43 students in Ayotzinapa. Yeah. And it's very difficult to see how the Mexican authorities are going to deal with that through 2015. It's unlikely that there'll be a massive popular revolt, but there'll just be constant conflict between people demanding that the system changes and the system kind of pushing back and refusing to change. So who knows what's going to happen there. 2016 in Argentina is a big year because there's an election at the end of the year. Yeah. And Cristina Kirchner can't stand for the presidency. Right. So we really don't. There's a lot of uncertainty about what's likely to happen in Argentina. Uruguay is likely to continue its progressive policies under Tabaré Vázquez, who will be taking up his second presidency following in the footsteps of Pepe Mujica. And in Chile, Michelle Bachelet looks as though she's on course to maintain her balancing act of keeping on good relations with the United States, promoting the corporate free trade agenda of the Chilean business classes, but also doing what she can to get closer to the processes of regional integration that are in train through organizations like the Union of South American States and the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. Mm-hmm. So, and it's likely to be it's going to be a mixed year, difficult year, but one on the whole that's just going to continue the trends that we've seen through 2014. It's extremely unlikely that United States government policy is going to be creative enough to engage with the processes, the integration processes in Latin America, in a way that is able to further its neoliberal agenda. I remember back in 2006, whenever it was, 2008, Robert Callahan, who was John Negroponte's sidekick, Callahan was asked, do you think Obama's election will change U.S. foreign policy to Latin America? And he said, no, of course it won't. Latin American policy to Latin America has been the same for whatever it is, 50 years, and it's unlikely to change just because there's been a change of president. But I think we're in times now where that has to change.
Right.
And that traditional U.S. policy to Latin America has to change, not because they want it to, but because force of events is going to make them change.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.